Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope OPC in Grays Lake, Illinois. I'm delighted to be back with everybody today, especially because I have the whole crew with me at Hope OPC. We're recording around a literal round table, which is quite spectacular because usually we're always doing our episodes over Skype, etc. But today we're here and present. Let me go around the table introducing everybody. We have Glenn Clary, who serves as pastor of Providence OPC in Pflugerville, Texas. Welcome, Glenn.
Thanks, Camden.
We also have Jeff Waddington, who's stated supply of Knox OPC in Lansdowne. Welcome back, Jeff.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, great to be here. Great to have you with us. And we also have Jim Cassidy, who's pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas. Welcome back, Jim.
The last of the theological knights of the round table. It's good to be here, Camden.
I don't know what that makes me. I'm here keeping everybody together, I guess.
Keeping it real.
Keeping it real. Mm-hmm. So thanks for coming out here to the conference and coming out to the Chicagoland area again. You know, two Texans and one guy from, well, you're originally from Massachusetts, aren't you, Jeff?
New York,
Massachusetts, up in that, the Northeast, yeah. So it's always great to have everybody here in person. We're going to be talking today about Van Til, talking a bit about Van Til and Scholasticism. Of course, we're all here and present, ready for the Reformed Forum Conference, but some guys have come in early so that we could get together and record some episodes in person, which is always a great advantage, and we love it. Sometimes the recordings end up, I have to do a lot more editing when we're in person because either things get out of hand or who knows what the reason is. But
the last fist fight that you had to edit out was quite interesting.
Yeah. That sound was that sounded bad. Yeah. Well, fortunately, that's one main reason we don't do video, you know, so it's harder to edit the video out. With the sound, we can at least mute. Yeah, well, we're going to talk Van Til and Scholasticism, but before we do that, I do have a few things to mention. Of course, as I always mention, Christ the Center is listener-supported, and you can find information about supporting us online at reformedforum.org/donate. We are a 501c3 organization, and that means that your contributions in support of our mission are tax-deductible to the fullest extent of the law recognized by the IRS in the United States. And so we do encourage you to visit us there and help us to pledge your support. We do rely on the generous support of all of our listeners and viewers and everyone who's helping us out so that we're able to do these things and produce a lot of material. We've been doing this for roughly 10 years. In January, it'll be 10 years. And we've been going at it for a long time, but we're so blessed and privileged to be able to do what we do, but we wouldn't be possible without your help. So I do want to thank everybody for their support of everything we do at Reformed Forum, and especially this program, our flagship program, as it were, Christ the Center. While you're at the website, of course, you'll be able to visit the online store. That's relatively new, and we always have some fun things there. We have a lot of new merchandise available. We've got some 1517 Wittenberg stickers. We have hats, shirts, mugs, all that sort of stuff, but also usually a good stream of some rare Reformed books that are right along our interests in our tradition. We were just looking at some real special copies of some books. Ryan Noah has brought some over, so we'll see what's left. But even if we sell out at the conference of all the really, really fun and special stuff, then no doubt there will be more coming on into the future. We had a copy of Voss's Mosaic Origin of the Pentateuchal Codes, 1886 first edition. So that got snatched up, you know, not too long after we posted the episode where we described that. We have currently in the store, again, this is before the conference will occur, so I don't know when people get together and start talking.
This is kind of a tease for our listeners.
This might even go out like a couple months later, and I apologize for the already not yet aspect of this recording. But we have some very clean first edition copies of Voss's Grace and Glory from 1922, I believe. I don't have one of those myself, so I have my eye on one of those. I have the Banner edition, but anyway, there's always some nice stuff out there, but if you'd like to get yourself a rare copy, perhaps a signed copy of something by Van Til, there's some special stuff. I just saw a Machen signature. I don't know if that's going to hit the store, but I don't know how he does it, but Mr. Ryan Noah is helping us out, and there's some great stuff at reformedforum.org/store. All that being said, we thank you for your support financially, prayerfully, and also just through encouragement of everything we do here in a variety of ways. So thanks so much. Well, guys, today we're going to talk Cornelius Van Til and scholasticism. Some people might not know exactly what scholasticism is. You know, I grew up as a child and we used to have these book fairs at the grade school, and it was scholastic books. So is that what we're talking about? Van Til and elementary school book fairs? No. Jeff, what is scholasticism, and why is this a significant, worthy topic?
Well, the understanding of scholasticism probably in the last 150 years was the idea that the theologians who came after the reformers, say Calvin, they reverted to a less than warm biblical theological approach to a dry, arid, Aristotelian, or I suppose Platonic, philosophical framework for doing their theology. People like Turretin, Van Maastricht, and the like were seen in this light, and they were compared negatively to folks like Calvin. Now, Richard Muller, back now 30-some years ago, and then most recently with the republication of the first two volumes of his Post-Reformation Reformed Dogmatics, and then the full set, four-volume set, in 2003, I think it was, has offered an alternative probably a corrective to that. Scholasticism is simply academic theology, recognizing that those who are referred to as scholastics, those who are concerned with the institutionalization of Protestantism, so Protestant scholastics we're thinking of in particular, were those who were responsible for the training of pastors, the writing of confessions, the seeing to it that Protestantism created institutions that would perpetuate the faith. Muller will argue that scholasticism was not, it was a method. Academic theology is over against a particular view. Like, we know that Lutherans, Reformed, Arminians, Socinians, and others, Roman Catholics, all practiced scholastic theology. Scholasticism is typically, you see it in the forms of, you see it in Thomas Aquinas, of course. But also in Francis Turretin's Institutes of Hellenic Theology, yeah, where you start out with the state of the question or the problem, right? And then you go, what is it? What kind is it? And then you talk about all various viewpoints, and then you state, the particular theologian would state his particular view. And so it's very thorough. Some would say it's not only comprehensive but exhaustive and exhausting to read.
Maybe even a little pedantic at times.
A little pedantic, yes. Repetitive, right? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Very much into technical terminology, that kind of thing. But my experience has been, at the very least, the subject matter is usually dealt with in a thorough way, whether you agree ultimately with the particular issue being discussed and the author's take on things. So that's what scholasticism is. So Richard Muller's revolution in church history and historical theology has what's the word I want to use, rehabilitated scholasticism, so that it's no longer shorthand for, no longer a dirty word, it's no longer
something to scare you away,
right? Yeah, it's as it kind of became.
Sometimes you see that also with the terminology schoolmen,
Yes, schoolmen. That would be the same thing. It's but academic theology. It's theology done in an academic setting. I meant to say as over against preaching sermons or writing a catechism or a confession. We understand those distinctions. So it's specifically the academic theology, both prior to the Reformation in Roman Catholicism, and then after the Reformation began, the institutionalization of the Reformation.
And in the Middle Ages, if I understand correctly, there was not only the scholastic way of doing theology, but the monastic approach to theology. So scholastic theology and monastic theology.
And mysticism.
And they
weren't necessarily mutually exclusive.
There would have been overlap. Yeah. So here's a follow-up question. Oftentimes in the literature, you'll hear a distinction between scholastic method on the one hand and then scholastic content on the other. Would you be able to maybe just talk a little bit about that distinction and maybe why it's important? So for instance, you could see, let's say, some in terms of method, you can see some continuity between Thomas, for example, and then Turretin, right? You know, that kind of very fine breaking things down, making careful distinctions and being exhaustive and exhausting. And then, but if you, of course, read the content between Turretin and Thomas, you know, greater differences will arise to the surface. So,
and Richard Muller goes into a fair bit of detail addressing that issue because of the history going back to the late 19th century into the 20th century and the neo-Orthodox church history and his assessment of historical theology. There was a critical assessment of scholasticism, which was I don't think it was historically accurate, and there are various things we could say about that. But the distinction between scholastic method, well, Muller would say that scholasticism is a method; it's academic theology, it's technical theology, as over against preaching or as over against doing a catechism. Scholasticism, in terms of content, could vary. As you've already pointed out, you can have Thomas Aquinas, who's the quintessential Roman Catholic medieval theologian, and then you have Francis Turretin, the Italian Swiss Reformed theologian in Geneva, and no doubt Turretin learned from Thomas, because Thomas is in the bloodstream. More that we can say and will say, no doubt, about that. But scholasticism, in terms of content, you have differing perspectives. You have Roman Catholicism, you have Lutheranism, you have the Reformed, and Reformed would cover both the continent and the UK. So it's not merely a continental phenomenon with the situation in the UK being different. There are various, we would consider the Westminster Assembly to be a scholastic body, even though what they produce technically, I suppose, is not a scholastic literature per se. So, and then you have Arminians and Socinians all practicing the scholastic method. So unlike what some have suggested in the past, that adopting the method predetermines the result, Muller, at least, and those who follow him would say that it does not.
Right, which is very helpful, especially in the kind of wake of the Calvin versus the Calvinist, kind of presupposition, I guess, through the early, mid-20th century, trying to pit Calvin against the Reformed scholastics. Muller comes as a welcomed correction to
that. What I had said earlier about the Calvin is the high watermark of the Reformation, and everything else is a declension from him.
Right.
Okay. That's a quick and dirty way of saying the Calvin versus the Calvinist distinction. And Muller is not so simplistic as to say it's all continuity. he would say it's continuity and development. In other words, there are going to be areas where theologians that come after Calvin depart from him. There are going to be ways in which they develop him, in some areas where they remain the same. And one of the other points that Muller and those in the Muller school will point out, perhaps ad nauseum to some of us, is that Calvin was not the only reformer, not the only reformed reformer. There were others. He and others formed a band of brothers, if you will, of like-minded reformers, going back to Zwingli, Bullinger, Beza, Knox, all of Bucer. So you've got all of these folks. So Melanchthon, right? So the very and they didn't all overlap chronologically, but Calvin was not all alone. It wasn't even just Luther and Calvin, right? There were many Lutherans as well as Reformed folk ministering, trying to further the Reformation in their cities where they served in various churches and academies.
So how does this history or tradition then come to bear upon Van Til and his understanding and reaction against scholasticism? Because we see it even recently compared to Van Til as Gerhardus Voss. Now we're reading his Reformed Dogmatics. We have that translated in English. It's a scholastic format, but yet Van Til also has a great antipathy at times with the schoolmen. But what is he speaking of when he's reacting against scholasticism?
Well, that I suppose it looks to me as if he's got primarily Thomas Aquinas in his scope, and those in that school of theology. For instance, to give an analogy, when Calvin criticizes the schoolmen in the institutes, he has, for the most part, the faculty of the Sorbonne. It's not every last individual scholastic, but a specific group of scholastic theologians that he's aiming at. But he doesn't say that in so many words. And so if you don't know the historical context, it's easy to forget that he had particular people in mind, even if he didn't say so. Thankfully, Calvin was not so pedantic that every time he had a disagreement with certain scholastic theologians, he didn't have to stop and say, "And by the way, I mean, by scholastic, I mean,"
and start naming
faculty.
Names.
Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah. That would have made for pedantic reading, certainly. And so, so Calvin is not necessarily himself against a more rigorous, even fine-tuned theology or an academic theology.
No, I don't think so. What was I going to say? The institutes are not in, although we may think they are in that kind of a semi-scholastic mode, they are not. The scholastic mode is, as you know, is divvied up into questions and answers. And then you get, on the other hand, I say, the following people say this. And then at the end of this long list, descriptive list, you get, on the other hand, I say, and you answer, and then you provide your positive case for your position.
It's rabbinic, almost.
Almost. It's almost like that. And there is the citation of authorities, church fathers in particular. Although even in Calvin, I believe St. Augustine is the most cited church father, along with
Bernard is the second, who is a monastic theologian, not a scholastic theologian.
Which is interesting, isn't it? And, of course, Augustine would be considered, I guess, more monastic. He predates the rise of the universities, for which the schoolmen are named after.
So in Van Til's criticism of scholasticism, he's not going after the methodology of scholastic theology.
Well, certainly I don't think it's being academic
in a sense,
is a problem.
Yeah, because there's two ways to parse this, because you can look at the theological method of Thomas Aquinas and consider, you know, theories of revelation and how general and special revelation relate upon how reason might interact, especially in a fallen condition, in a fallen state, and what the capacity is and the powers and abilities of reason. Those are methodological issues that Van Til will be very critical of. But yet there is other method of organizing theology that you would find speaking more or less about format, but it's also the way the mind works that you see that I don't think he would have a problem with at all. That he wouldn't be critical of the way Turretin's systematic is laid out, or Voss's Reformed Dogmatics. And so that still is a theological method. So there are also different ways, I think, even of thinking about method. And Jeff, you mentioned several moments ago on how there could be a criticism and a fear that your method will determine the result. Well, in one regard, when we speak about Thomas's method and his understanding of revelation and the what he can ascribe to the human reason, that is a method that will ultimately determine a certain result.
Although I do detect a difference in the use of the word method.
Equivocation here.
Yes. Equivocation going on.
Indeed. But that's my point, right, that there are a couple ways that we can be using.
And they're not necessarily mutually opposed, are they? In other words, they may interrelate, and that's why this becomes a complicated issue.
Sure. So, for example, you could consider Turretin or other Reformed Protestant scholastics, that you could say, well, they're scholastics, so they're the same method. In a sense, they have the same method as Thomas. In another sense, a very different method.
Yeah. So depending on if you're talking about pedagogical method versus, let's say, theological method.
I think so.
You know, the theological method would be more akin to what we would call prolegomena, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the study of first things and stuff to be said ahead of time in terms of how we're going to develop our theology.
Right. Yeah. And it's Thomas's dualistic epistemology.
That's his theological method.
Yeah,
it's a problem.
That theological method, yeah.
Right.
There are two sources of knowledge, mm-hmm. right? Natural revelation, special revelation.
Sacred.
And by the right use of reason, mm-hmm. one can correctly interpret natural revelation to arrive at truths about God.
You know? A theologia vera. Mm-hmm. You know, to bring
truth
in
theology,
some Protestant scholastic language.
Well, Glenn's kind of thrown the grenade, I guess, in the middle of the floor here, and that's good, because it really gets at the central issue, I think, of what differentiates Thomas. If we're going to take Thomas as sort of the target scholastic that Van Til is aiming at, in my reading of Van Til, anyway, he uses the language of scholasticism, I think, very sparingly, but he's always concerned about what he calls Roman Catholic theology, right? You know, Romish theology or whatever. Catholic theology, Catholic forms of apologetics, and he really seems to have in view here Thomas Aquinas particularly. So it might be helpful for us if we, focus on what Glenn, you know, has kind of started us down, that trail that Glenn's kind of started us down here, talking about Thomas's theological method and how Van Til, criticized it would be, I think a place to go.
Van Til is very good in reminding us that Thomas is, at the end of the day, is a Roman Catholic theologian. Mm-hmm. Now, yes, he lived
prior
to the Reformation, so he's part of the general Western Christian tradition, and that's a fact. However, that doesn't mean that we have to take him hook, line, and sinker. You know, all aspects of him or any aspects of him. But the point is we need to bring him to the bar of Scripture and sound theological principles.
So maybe this would be a question to throw out there. I'm looking at Jeff here, but of course anyone around the table here would be good to hear from. What is the essence of, or maybe the heart of Van Til's critique of Thomas's epistemology?
Well, you've got the first thing that we should say is that Thomas has as his goal the synthesis of Christian theology or doctrine and Aristotelian philosophy. So Thomas comes after the rediscovery of many of Aristotle's writings. I believe the writings were limited to a certain small subset of his writings in prior to the couple hundred years before the life of Albert the Great, who was Thomas's mentor, and therefore the through Muslim intermediaries, if I remember correctly, mm-hmm. Thomas or
they
Aristotle's
did many of the
writings.
Translations,
yeah,
and then also commented on them.
And so you get both the translations and commentary in that Thomas is seeking, therefore, he obviously thinks that Aristotle is worth bringing into conversation with Christian theology.
But he also has an evangelistic purpose behind that, because Muslim theologians had already done that.
True.
And he's doing the same thing for Christian theology. But didn't he write, not Summa Theologia, but Summa Contra Gentiles?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which was an evangelistic, apologetic work.
A handbook for missionaries to Moorish Spain, if I remember correctly. And in there he talks about, he actually gives us a window into his methodology, apologetic methodology, if we can call it that, or missionary methodology, which is you can argue using the Old Testament with Jews, you can argue using the New Testament with Christian heretics, but with Muslims and other non-Christian, non-Jews, you have to use reason, I guess, would be his argument.
Aristotle. That's common ground.
Common ground. Yeah.
So he's appropriating Aristotle in the service of Christian theology in the same way that Origen was using Neoplatonic philosophy in Alexandria, Egypt.
Right. Yeah, or Justin, perhaps?
Or Justin Martyr. Justin Martyr.
Yeah, both.
Yeah.
So that's very helpful, because we start with the synthesis. I mean, there's no doubt that when you read Van Til, his primary concern is with a synthesis of Christian thought with unbelieving thought. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where it begins. So from there, what is Van Til's primary concerns with Thomas in the way in which he synthesizes Aristotle relative to epistemology and then apologetics?
Well, you have the big bugbear, of course, is the embrace of the great chain of being. Mm-hmm. The analogia entis, the idea that God is at the top of the chain, and that inanimate matter is at the bottom of the chain, and man is somewhere in between on this ladder.
This is chain. A contentious issue.
Yes, it is. But even the way I'm presenting it, because
we get the emails.
Thomas is not uniformly interpreted. Even by Thomas, to believe that God is in the chain,
because he has at least two analogies.
Yes, analogy of intrinsic attribution and analogy of proper proportion.
Right. So how those two relate to one another is a subject of great interest to many Thomists, and it ought to be to all readers of Thomas as well.
And there, of course, are even other analogies. There are three or four or five. I've lost track over the years. But this is how Van Til understands Thomas to be his discussion of the use of human language applied to God. Okay, Van Til saw Thomas building off of the chain of being. In other words, the reason why we can use human knowledge or human language applied to God is because there's a chain of being at which God is at the top. And matter, inanimate matter, is at the bottom, and humans are in between.
Whether Van Til had Thomas correct or not on that issue, that's nevertheless what he's going after.
Yes, and I would say that that's a legitimate concern to have. You know, whether that's historically, whether Thomas actually held to that is an important question. But that's what That's what, as I understand Van Til, that's what he was going
on. And he's not the only one to have such concerns. No. He doesn't have an idiosyncratic.
No.
Some people would say he has a faulty interpretation, but it's at least not idiosyncratic.
No, he's not alone in his concerns.
Right. Well, perhaps Van Til is also thinking that Thomas's system demands it. Whether mm-hmm. Thomas would actually agree with it or not, or ever that's explicitly says it or not.
Vantillian approaches to apologetics and polemics.
Right. The logical necessity of a position, whether Thomas himself is demonstrated to actually have held that God was a part of the chain of being. Mm-hmm. That is how many have understood God's relationship to creation, is that he's at the upper end of the ladder and that the creation is at the bottom end of the ladder.
And it comes from a hylomorphism. The fact that all existence is a combination and is a complete utter lack of adequate language here, but is a mixture or combination of form and matter. Yes, exactly. So, and also the way that act and potency interact with one another. So for God, he is pure act. He has no potential, no potency. But human beings have both act and potency, but we share in being. We participate in being, although we are caused and moved, and God is not caused. He's uncaused. He's the first mover who starts a great chain of causality because he is uncaused, but everything else is caused. These are the kinds of things that when you read the proofs, they come to the fore, and I'm sure many people are starting to be familiar with some of these terms and the way that they're used. But this is where Van Til will start to see this chain.
It's in the five ways.
Among many other places.
Well, one of the five ways is proportionality.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Proportion, right? That's mm-hmm. one of the five ways mm-hmm. that Thomas explicates for proof for the existence of God.
Mm-hmm. So here's the question then. Why is that I'm not skeptical here. Just setting you up. why is that a problem? Why is the chain of being, the analogia entis, for Van Til and then as well for us, why is that a problem?
For Bart.
Yeah.
Right, Jim?
And for Bart for different reasons. Yeah. Similar
so
but different reasons.
So you're seeing Van Til and Bart are on the same side of something?
Yeah, that's a whole other episode.
Yeah.
Well, they must agree on everything if they agree on something, right? Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
Well, then you're getting into that formal similarity.
Yeah.
And that's what you have there, I think.
Sure. Right.
But anyways, the problem is, of course, that it runs roughshod or obliterates the creator-creature distinction.
What's the word we use for that? And I mean, I'm just setting you up here again, but univocism is what I'm driving. There's a univocal relationship that obtains between the creator.
When we use the expression that's univocal, whether it be in terms of metaphysics or ontology or epistemology.
Clark, that's the issue with Clark. Mm-hmm.
So that mm-hmm. what we're saying is identity.
Yep.
Basically, so God and creation are one and the same. That's pantheism. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's
the most extreme form, right?
Yeah, that would be the most extreme form.
So Thomas, of course, wouldn't hold to that, at least not in an explicit way, a pantheistic view. But there's
undoubtedly he would deny that.
He would deny it. So, but there is one thing that Van Til, I think, brings out that's important, which is the fact that being, on Thomas's view and views that are like him, or at least in Van Til's view of Thomas. Being then becomes sort of a capture category, right? Where a catch-all category,
in which you
an abstraction. Yeah. That's the word that Van Til uses
capital
is an abstraction.
Being often mm-hmm. in the literature,
in which
capital
both God and we participate,
right? At different levels,
right?
Yeah, but nevertheless, an abstract category in which we mm-hmm. both participate.
That's the question: what is the level? Is it merely that God is pure act? It's the same being, but he has no potency. Mm-hmm. Or is that a difference enough where it satisfies more or less Van Til's concerns that he would draw on the board every time he'd have class? Two circles connected by a line. He speaks about covenant and a distinction between creator and creature. That's why he started every lecture that way, because it was so significant and fundamental.
We would say that if you want to use the language of analogy, there's an analogia revelationis, an analogy of revelation, not an analogy of being. Mm. The problem with analogy of being is that it tends toward mm-hmm. monism or pantheism.
Yeah.
It goes there whether we intended to or not. That's right. how the that way of thinking where it arrives.
Yeah, but again, to put a point on Glenn's statement or what he pointed out, is it the case that we could say, is it true that God exists? Yes.
Yes.
Is it true that humans exist? Yes. So is there an identity at that point? No. but that's the issue, because other people would say, yes, we could say the most basic thing. And this is what philosophy always attempts to do. And this is what Van Til gets at when he's speaking of the problem of the one and the many. Yes. You can go all the way in one direction of the many or all the way in the other direction of the one. Now, if we start moving all the way in the direction of the many, he speaks about unintelligibility, because then we have focused so much on the particulars, nothing has anything. If we take it to its conclusion, at the particular level, nothing has anything in common with anything
else. Velocity.
So there's absolute no connection between any single datum, any point. Take it the other direction. You go all the way toward the commonality. When you start abstracting away, the computer programmers who understand object-oriented program know this. Like, and this is why I'm grateful for that training. It helped me in philosophy, oddly enough. If you start abstracting objects, then you start removing all the particulars so that you can treat the commonality in one place. Yes. And then it cascades.
The larger the group.
And then it cascades down. Right. So for dogs, you could start with dog and you abstract from a specific breed to the category of dog, but then you can lump that into the category of mammal, into the category of, you know, quadrupeds first, then mammals, then whatever. You go up the chain, you start removing all the particulars.
Mm-hmm. This is not accidental, because this is part of the Aristotelian understanding of oh, wow. That's, exactly. Wasn't even
they
intended.
Are accidents, actually.
That was correct. That was accidental.
But here's why I'm bringing this up, because if you abstract it all the way, as far as you possibly can, is it true? Then you can abstract beyond the triune God and arrive at capital B being, of which humans and God fall under the same category.
No. Not really.
That's the issue, though. I agree. No.
You can try in terms of intellectually epistemologically.
That is the crux of the issue. Theologically.
We might say it's categorization. It's the attempt to categorize God and creation under one large category. Mm-hmm. And we would say that there are at least two, but God and creation. There's an ultimate, not dualism, but duality. Like
there's God and creation. And then there's what he has made.
Correct. There's God and not God.
And they both exist.
And they both
but
exist.
But that existence is different. An analogy.
But if we reject that univocal relationship between God and man, how do we not inevitably end up in
an equivocal
relationship where God is unknowable, right?
Totally other. Thomas developed the notion of, he would offer analogy as the alternative to both the equivocism and univocism.
Right. Uh-huh. And so he's rightly aware of some of the issues, but Van Til would be critical of his responses.
Because of the chain of being, right? The ultimate metaphysic upon which Thomas's discussion would rest is the chain of being, which tends toward pantheism.
And rationalism on the epistemological level,
yes.
Right? So flesh that out a little bit for us, if you would.
Rationalism. Oh, go ahead.
I wasn't going to say
anything. Oh, okay. It looked like you were about to say something.
No.
Okay.
Definitely not now.
Epistemology.
Better to catch yourself early than later. Yeah.
This is what happens when we're not on Skype, right? You see, well, that's what you look like when you're whatever.
No. Okay.
But anyway, sorry.
Epistemology. No, I was just thinking epistemologically. There's so many different things. This is the bad thing about having read so much, is you think of all these threads that are dangling and you want to pull one. You know. So Thomas certainly, for instance, he talks about, he recognizes that man was created as a rational creature. I don't think any of us would have any qualms with that bare statement. How we fill in the details is where we would... Sure. You know, start having, you know, disagreement. In the fall, man's ability to think, to reason, is affected. by sin. And Thomas affirms that. He affirms what we would say are the noetic effects of sin. However, when you actually get into, I think, when you get into his discussion about how reason functions, he tends to talk of reason in the abstract. There we are again. Mm-hmm. Whereas, and this is where the Protestant scholastics as a group, and of course you could probably find exceptions to this, but the Protestant scholastics say that whenever you consider man as a creature, you cannot consider him abstractly. You must consider him in his fourfold estate: created, fallen, regenerated, in heaven. So that whenever you ask the question, what does it mean for, what is the function of reason? What is the capability of reason? You must ask, in what of those four estates are we talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And I found that helpful, that's not something, as far as I know, is in Thomas, that is in the Reformed scholastics. And so they would say, well, and there are scholars, and this comes from my work in Edwards, there are amongst the scholars who've looked at this issue of right reason, they would say that there's two streams. There's the Thomistic stream, and then there's the non-Thomistic stream, for lack of a better way of describing it. And the Thomistic stream tends to look at reason abstractly, in other words, or autonomously, and right reason in the other stream sees right reason as regenerate reason. Mm-hmm. Not reason in general, but reason that is being restored through the process of sanctification. And so Thomas is on the other side. He looks at the reason itself is not tarnished, twisted, fallen to such an extent that it interferes with man's ability to think about things in the world, as well as to think about things regarding the Christian faith.
So on that score then, how thinking particularly, well, okay, so more, even more generally than that particular instance, maybe I'll go from the general to the particular. So generally, what's the difference between how Thomas understands the relationship between general and special revelation on the one hand, and Van Til, and the way in which he understands the relationship between general and special revelation on the other?
Well, it's not. I could be wrong, and I'm happy to be corrected by someone who's better acquainted with, who's read Thomas more deeply. I've read Thomas on this material, but it's not something I've looked at recently. But it's not immediately clear to me that Thomas has a notion of natural revelation at all.
Yeah. There's just nature.
There's just nature and then grace or special revelation. Now, I knew that we would end up here sooner or later in this conversation about the donum super additum, and that's where we've arrived. That is the nature of Adam as created, and then the nature of Adam as fallen. Again, what I said earlier, the Protestant scholastics said you can't consider human reason or human man without considering where is he in his estates? Is he? Are we thinking of man as created? Are we thinking of him as fallen, as regenerate, that is on the way to being fully restored, and then in the new heavens and the new earth, and therefore fully restored?
Right, makes a difference.
Still a creature,
right?
Okay, still a creature, but no longer fallen.
That's right. That's right. So talk to us then maybe a little bit about, I think that you put your finger on something that's really important here. For Van Til, nature is always revelatory.
As I understand, this is given my understanding, and of course I don't make
for
a
Van
claim.
Til.
Or Thomas. Yep. I don't make a claim to be an expert on Thomas.
Yeah.
Van Til, in my mind, are virtually identical. That was a joke.
Okay. Yeah, you couldn't pick up the eye movement. So no.
Anyway, so for
Van Til, nature is always revelatory.
Yeah. Right? For Van Til, there's no such thing as a non-revelatory environment.
Right.
In other words, man is created in an environment in which God is revealing himself. Now, he'll be revealing himself either in nature, which includes human nature. So it's not just man looking out at the world around him. It's also man as he considers himself psychologically and so forth. And then there's special revelation. So there's natural revelation and there's special revelation. For Van Til, natural and special revelation work together in harmony. That's how it was in creation. Okay, so that special revelation is not merely the result of the fall. God is revealing himself in a special supernatural way prior to the fall to Adam and Eve in the garden.
That's true.
Okay, that's important. So that when he says, do not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that is not the basis. That is not something that Adam could have figured out from contemplating trees, right, or his navel.
Yeah.
Oh, whether he had one or not.
Reason or feelings don't get you there.
That requires verbal communication. The natural revelation is nonverbal. That prohibition is clearly verbal.
Yeah.
Okay. So that makes it a form of non-redemptive special revelation, or pre-fall non-redemptive special revelation, if you want to be very particular.
And that's not in Thomas.
I could be wrong, but even then I would have questions about what he understands natural revelation to be. But it appears to me that he is looking at nature as something in which we have to look out on creation and extrapolate through rationative or reasoning processes, through inferential processes, we may come to a natural knowledge of God.
We have to work our way up the
chain. Work our way up from the ground. Yeah, the chain of being, we work from the bottom up to the top.
That's the causality argument.
We would say to use language that we often use with regard to Christology, we're talking for Thomas a bottom-up epistemology. And for Van Til, it's a top-down epistemology.
Yeah, that's key. Yeah.
Okay, that's a big difference.
Yeah, that's huge. So
because it's revelatory.
It's revelatory.
Yeah.
That's right. It's not something that we look at. We look at the world around us, and through a process of inferential reasoning, we come to the conclusion that, well, given what I see in the world, God, there must be something like God.
I must therefore conclude.
Top down in the sense of an a priori epistemology.
No.
It's neither a priori nor a posteriori. Right. So man does consider the world and learn things.
Oh, certainly.
Yeah, I know, but I'm just saying for the.
But that's a good point. That's right.
That's a good point. Yeah.
It's both. If you want to think of a priori being rules or law based, and a posteriori being fact based, Van Til would affirm both.
Indeed,
in their proper properly understood.
And that's why he says there
qualified
are no brute facts.
Right.
Right.
There are no brute facts.
And when he says
there are no brute facts, he's not just saying everybody brings an interpretive group.
Yeah, he's not
table.
Merely saying we're all biased. That's
right.
not his.
Right.
I mean, that
it's
we
because
didn't need
God
Van
is
Til.
The ultimate interpreter.
Right. God's the ultimate interpreter.
And the ultimate revealer.
And revealer.
And revealer. Yeah. And revealer through everything.
So it appears, and this is something that you see even in Protestant theology up until, that the language of natural revelation is not common. You do see light of nature, for instance, in the Westminster Standards. And I think that properly is understood to be natural revelation.
Sure, yeah.
But if you see it in someone like Thomas, it's not clear to me that he understands that to mean natural revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And also going to Romans 1, where Paul talks about knowing God, they did not giving him glory. Thomas, as I understand it, looks at Romans 1 and says, well, God creates man with the potential of being able to figure him out from the world he has created.
Right.
We look at that and say, no, God has actually created us with knowledge.
That's right.
Okay, so that's one. All of these could become episodes in their own right, we understand.
We're opening up a...
Yeah, a can of worms.
I don't want to say Pandora box, but yeah, I mean, can of worms anyway, that we would have to.
Considering this is the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, a can of worms is something we probably should open.
Yeah, yeah. And start on a diet of worms. Yeah,
those are the guys over at Theology Simply Profound we're talking about. But they thought Herod's death was the first diet of worms.
That's brilliant. That's
cute.
That's
one word for it. Yes.
That is. That's great. That's brilliant.
Because he accepted the praise of the crowd when he wore that shiny garment.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. Anyways. Theology back of to, glory. So Tom, but the other thing is related to the donum super additum. What is the nature of Adam as created? Is Adam created neutral? Is Adam created holy? And so these are questions that you need to do. We need to wrestle with that relate to this whole issue. Does reason function properly without the moral image of God, or is it affected by the loss of the moral image or the narrower image?
Sure, and even man's own constitution, how he's created his intellect, but then also this body, and when the body comes into contact with the intellect and the rational faculties of man, what arises? And for many, and within Thomas, in a classical, Roman Catholic notion, there's a concupiscence or a self-love, yes, an inevitable drift towards self-love and away from God, which needs to be, as it were, balanced out or altered, fixed might be another.
Mitigated.
Whatever. That's a better, by a superadded grace. And that's what the donum superadditum is. But then when mankind falls into sin, he loses the donum superadditum, but retains his rational faculties.
Right. So,
which makes for the possibility of a classical apologetic.
Yes. So when you look at Turretin looks at Bellarmine and the issue of the loss of the donum superadded, the superadded gift. That is the ability, the suppression of concupiscence by holiness, put it simply. For the Protestants, the fall results in both the loss of what Roman Catholics would call the superadded gift. We would say the loss of the narrow image or the moral image.
True knowledge, righteousness, and holiness.
But and with the loss of the narrow image or the moral image, knowledge, righteousness, and holiness, the natural image is defaced, twisted, distorted. Okay, that's the Protestant, and I believe the biblical perspective. Mm-hmm. For Roman Catholicism, and this is certainly how Thomas is interpreted by Bellarmine, is that the natural image is left intact. And that's really what Van Til is getting at.
Sure.
When he's talking about right reason or he's talking about autonomous reasoning, mm-hmm, he's going after this notion that human reasoning can function properly, mm-hmm, with the loss of the narrow
image. In the second estate.
Right.
Basically, to go back to the fourfold estate terminology.
In the fallen estate.
That's when Van Til spends so much time on that.
Right.
He talks about, uses a lot of interesting illustrations and analogies as well. Pardon the pun there, too. I didn't mean that. But also, speaking about mankind's reason is like a buzzsaw that's broken and faulty, like somebody messed
it. It still cuts, but it cuts slanted, crooked, skewed, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's where people misunderstand Van Til. They think what he said is it can't cut anymore. No, he's saying it might cut and slant.
Unbelievers can't think.
Right.
In a matter of ways, I mean, we don't think properly.
Right.
As an unbeliever or as somebody affected by the fall into sin. But
or truly, can we say that? That we can't think truly? See, unbeliever can't think truly?
Yeah, we can say that, but we could still also, because of God's common grace, say that unbelievers can know true things.
True things. That's right. Yeah.
Could you flesh that out? What effect does common grace and Van Til's theology have at mitigating the noetic effects of sin?
Yeah. I don't know. I was hoping Jeff might be able to.
You're setting me up. Okay. Well, common grace, We would say when God said to Adam, don't eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for in the day you eat of it, you will surely die. So many people say, well, why didn't Adam die? Adam and Eve die right then and there. By which they mean physically as well as spiritually. The answer we would give, one of the answers, of course, is common grace. That is, that God has chosen to delay the judgment that would have fallen upon Adam and Eve, which is to allow room for grace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Extension.
Special grace.
Special grace.
Common grace serves special grace.
Correct. Yes. Common grace is never meant to function on its own.
Or just a neutral venue.
Yeah. It's a subservient grace. Mm-hmm. It's meant to create the space or the content. It's meant to create a safe space.
Oh no.
So do you
no triggers?
That?
No triggers.
No triggers. No. And it's meant to create a Van Til and Voss, I think, use the language of playground upon which special grace can flourish.
Which should be a safe space.
Yeah. Which would be a safe space, so, ultimately. Yeah,
yeah. But is that all common grace does?
It's a restraint of judgment, but it's also any positive blessing. I mean, Murray's definition, any blessing that comes upon the sin-cursed world that falls short of salvation. So Matthew 5:45, that God causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust, a classic.
And the sun to shine.
Those are all
and the mathematicians to come maybe, to four when they ask what 2 + 2 is.
And maybe just to go one step further and to kind of come full circle, would Van Til be willing to say that Aristotle had true insights because of common grace?
Well, I think I can speak for myself as a Van Tilian and say that I never want to say I never want to shut off when I hear someone say, well, I was reading Aristotle, and I don't want to be understood to be saying, well, then you don't have to bother reading him because there's obviously nothing he has to teach us because he's an unbeliever. That's one extreme. The other extreme would be to teach that Aristotle was a believer in secret. And by that, I don't mean anonymous Christian.
We don't want to go there.
But there, in the history of the church,
a lot of the patristics, the church fathers, would say that about some of the ancient
Plato, Aristotle,
and Rotter, right.
the best of the philosophers.
Just them. Anybody.
So here's the thing. From what I understand, according to Van Til, and this goes to Glenn's question a little bit more. If this is my language, this isn't his, but the way I understand what he's saying is that to know something truly, you have to have a true eschatology. So that, in other words, if we deny that God is the Lord of history, who has a destination, right, for his people, who has a final point, or to use the language of the Westminster Shorter Catechism, who has taught us that the chief end of man is to glorify him and enjoy him forever, the unbeliever cannot know something truly because it would be in abstraction from that eschatological goal, which is the glory of God.
Yes, that would be correct. And we can't know anything truly if we remove God from the picture. It would be another way, less nuanced.
Not even the facts of his so-called facts of history. So, for instance, George Washington won the war at Princeton, right?
I thought Machen did.
Nice.
No?
He did
talk about
later.
Confusion of church and state.
Confusion of church and state, that's right. That's great. Good. But That's awesome. So that even that fact, if we abstract that fact from the overall plan of God, right, which is to eventually bring all things to be reconciled in Christ to himself in everlasting glory, right, his people. Van Til uses the language of God and his decree, which stands back of all things, right? If we abstract any fact from that overall thing, what we have done is falsified it in some sense. Right.
But Van Til also uses the language of borrowed
capital. Capital. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
Perhaps stolen capital is a better term for that. But the borrowed capital are truths that they can't account for outside of Christian.
Right. That's right.
So they have an insight into some aspect of truth, but they aren't able to justify their insight.
neither
epistemologically,
and neither to place it on a proper foundation.
Correct. Yeah.
So back to our original topic of the appropriation of someone like Aristotle, for example, for Christian theology, is there a legitimate role, mm-hmm. is there a legitimate place for doing something like that, mm-hmm. provided it's done from a fully Christian perspective and not coming at it from the perspective of what do we hold in common.
Not synthesis.
Yeah, not right. synthesizing.
But antithesis, it, yeah. right. Yeah, yeah.
yeah.
So,
antithetical retrieval.
But, antithetical retrieval. There you go. Yeah.
If I can go
antithetical
back,
resourcement. Right. Yeah.
You all know the phrase, plundering the Egyptians,
yes.
right, which
yeah.
is used.
There's a book on the shelf right up there, Plundering the Egyptians.
It has oh, really? To do with Westminster's uh-huh. Old Testament fact.
Yes, that's right. It goes back to Augustine, right? And right, his right. the question was that the Augustine raises on the Christian teacher, on Christian doctrine.
yeah, De Doctrina Christiana.
Is on that topic.
And actually, I think he even gets it from Origen, who, in giving a justification for what he's doing with Neoplatonic thought, is that he's plundering the Egyptians, right? He's gleaning
from their
best
insight. So
there's
an older pedigree than Augustine. Even
right. Not too much older, but yeah, a little older.
Kind of like Acts 17 in some ways.
Okay, you know? Very good. Yeah, very right. good example.
He doesn't, he's not, is he, the, Paul yeah. is subverting, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you know, in right. an antithetical way, and yet mm-hmm. also starting with something that he sees.
A grain of truth they have with borrowed capital.
Yeah, right. yeah, right.
So there, maybe at the end of the day, the criticism comes down to you haven't done it well enough. Mm-hmm. In other words, and to use the language of Scott Oliphant in The Battle Belongs to the Lord, it's twisted truth. Common grace produces
twisted
truth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Christian is to untwist the truth. If they discover some element of truth in an unbeliever, in unbelieving thought, and they need to untwist it. Mm-hmm. Or to use the language of Augustine, he uses baptized, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, and of course, the analogy... Christianize, right?
You have to take it and set it within the eschatological context
correct.
As it's been given to us in
so
special revelation.
Clean it off, remove the debris yeah. of unbelief and, right. and untwist it. And to put it in the new setting. The twist?
Untwist again. Yeah.
Oh, there we go.
Like we did last summer.
Chubby Checker. Wow, that's great.
You have to, it could be your anthem. I mean,
there
we
you
could,
go.
We could start selling singles or 45s even now with this resurgence,
again.
The Revenge of the Analog, right, Glenn?
Yeah. Revenge of the Analog.
Jeff Waddington, untwist again.
Untwist again.
Well, you know, Chubby Checker was from, well, he lives in Philadelphia. Anyways, that's.
We digress.
But this,
we digress.
I mean, this has been a great discussion. Again, I mean, we've had how many episodes throughout the years on Van Til and these ideas, and you can find all those in the archive. And we're looking to explore many of these issues. I'm looking forward to Scott Oliphant's two plenary addresses. Lane Tipton's going to talk about Acts 17 and the notion of facts and evidence. But, you know, by the time that our listeners hear this episode, these will be available, presumably, on the website because we plan to live stream them and we also plan to place up edited recordings, you know, where the audio is nice and tidy and cleaned up. They'll be online. So there's a lot to discuss, and we've only opened up many of the issues, but we hope that it's been fruitful to you. And you can find out more information about all of these topics online at reformedforum.org. And certainly we want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.